Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare & Company podcast with me, Adam Miles, recorded in our writer's studio just above the bookshop at Kilometer Zero in Paris. If you enjoy these conversations, there are a few different ways you can support us. First of all, you can leave a rating right now in whatever podcast app you're using. The more ratings we get, the more likely it is that people will discover us. It only takes a few seconds and can really help spread the word. You can also buy books, gifts, and apparel from our online store, shakespeareandcompany.com, where you'll find our popular Year of Reading subscription, 12 books handpicked by our dedicated booksellers, shipped to you or a loved one wherever they are in the world. Finally, you can become a friend of Shakespeare & Company by joining the association we set up to get us through a difficult few years. Membership gives you access to exclusive online content, as well as other treats depending on the tier you choose. Find out more at friendsofshakespeareandcompany.com. I'll be back at the end, but until then, sit back and enjoy the Shakespeare & Company podcast. After Krishan receives a call informing him that Rani, his grandmother's former caretaker, has recently died in a sudden and brutal fashion, he makes the decision to travel from Colombo to her native northern province to attend her funeral. As he rides the train, his thoughts turn to the past, both personal and societal, the most significant romantic relationship of his young life, how it grew and how it ended, but also Sri Lanka's brutal civil war and its aftermath. In this way, A Passage North is a journey forward through space, but also backwards into memory, or, as Krishan reflects at a moment, a journey from the south of his mind to its own distant northern reaches. A Passage North is a masterclass in restraint and tone, conjuring a deeply affecting, layered story in mesmerising crystalline prose. It is this mastery that has recently seen Anuk Aridprakasam shortlisted for the 2021 Booker Prize, and I'm delighted to say that he joins us in the writer's studio today. Anuk, welcome to Shakespeare & Company.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. When I was thinking about where to begin this conversation, it struck me that it's quite difficult to find a way in, partly because A Passage North is a book which unfolds very sort of gently and takes its time to sort of reveal itself to the reader. So where I thought we would begin is with Krishan. How did this character reveal himself to you? Was it in the writing of the book, in the drafting as the book developed? Was it as he reveals himself to us, sort of slowly, gradually, layer by layer, if you like? Or was it did he come to you more fully formed?
It's a good question, because I don't actually often think in terms of characters when I begin to when I begin to write. Really, I usually start with I have certain images, I have certain observations, I have certain moods, and a major mood that I want to run through the text. But I don't often think in terms of characters. And in that sense, I'm not sure that Krishan is a very interesting character per se, or at least he's surrounded in the book by people who have more fascinating stories and more painful stories. And so in a sense, Krishan really was a kind of vessel or a kind of consciousness through which I wanted to mediate this text's response to the world that it is about. And for that, Krishan needed to have certain kinds of, he needed to be part of a certain social class, he needed to be middle or upper middle class, he needed to be bilingual. But really, he's kind of a vessel. And I wanted the book to be, unlike my first book, something that was closer to my experience of the war, which is to say, from the point of view of not somebody who was in the midst of things during 2008 and 2009, in this period of great, great violence and death, which was the perspective of my first novel, and which for me was a very much an imagined and projective perspective. Sure. Because I've had no personal experience of war whatsoever. I wanted this text to be from the consciousness or from the point of view of somebody who was standing outside, who was watching from a distance, who was witness, which was in fact the case for most Tamils from the north and east, because 1.5 million Tamils are diasporic, and so 1.5 million Tamils watched as the other 1.5 million Tamils was subject to this kind of historical catastrophe. And so I wanted to write a book about what it was to witness in silence and be without agency.
Mm.
So Krishan, in a sense, is a character without agency. He watches. The present, we assume, is eternally before us, one of the few things in life from which we cannot be parted. It overwhelms us in the painful first moments of entry into the world, when it is still too new to be managed or negotiated, remains by our side during childhood and adolescence, in those years before the weight of memory and expectation. And so it is sad and little unsettling to see that we become, as we grow older, much less capable of touching, grazing, or even glimpsing it, that the closest we seem to get to the present are those brief moments we stop to consider the spaces our bodies are occupying, the intimate warmth of the sheets in which we wake, the scratched surface of the window on a train taking us somewhere else, as if the only way we can hold time still is by trying physically to prevent the objects around us from moving. The present, we realize, eludes us more and more as the years go by, showing itself for fleeting moments before losing us in the world's incessant movement, fleeing the second we look away and leaving scarcely a trace of its passing. Or this at least is how it usually seems in retrospect, when in the next brief moment of consciousness, the next occasion we are able to hold things still, we realize how much time has passed since we were last aware of ourselves, when we realize how many days, weeks, and months have slipped by without our consent. Events take place, moods ebb and flow, people and situations come and go, but looking back during these rare junctures in which we are, for whatever reason, lifted up from the circular daydream of everyday life, we are slightly surprised to find ourselves in the places we are, as though we were absent while everything was happening, as though we were somewhere else during the time that is usually referred to as our life. Waking up each morning, we follow by circuitous routes the thread of habit, out of our homes, into the world, and back to our beds at night, move unseeingly through familiar paths, one day giving way to another and one week to the next, so that when in the midst of this daydream something happens and the thread is finally cut, when, in a moment of strong desire or unexpected loss, the rhythms of life are interrupted, we look around and are quietly surprised to see that the world is vaster than we thought, as if we'd been tricked or cheated out of all that time, time that in retrospect appears to have contained nothing of substance, no change and no duration, time that has come and gone but left us somehow untouched.
I find that really interesting that you say that Krishan isn't a particularly sort of interesting character in himself, because that wasn't my feeling actually when I was reading it. And I think it's certainly something that Krishan would think of himself. And it's interesting that you as the writer also think that of him, because for me, one of the associations that I made, and this only came to me after I'd finished reading the novel, was he reminded me in certain ways of Meursault, Camus' Étranger, and who I think is one of the most compelling characters of 20th century literature, but also in many ways kind of a vessel as well. And I think, I suppose what sort of unites them in my mind is this sort of sense of alienation and this sense of kind of disconnect that you just mentioned, this sort of separation from the historical events of the war, but also, you know, a connection nonetheless. I mean, I think one of the most striking moments with Krishan, and partly because it's so sort of underplayed in the book, is there's a moment where you write that his father was killed in a bombing in Colombo, but he doesn't really consider himself particularly impacted by the violence of the war. And those two sort of observations set alongside each other had a really sort of powerful effect of creating this sense of kind of somebody who'd been almost sort of emptied out by his life events.
Yeah, I think it's this detail that comes up very briefly at two moments in the book, the fact that Krishan's father died, and that he died in a bomb set off by the Tigers, one of the more famous bombings in 1996. But he never really dwells on his father. It's almost like a space that he that is surrounded by some kind of invisible wall. You don't sense as you read the text that that the character is avoiding something per se, but it is a notable or a striking absence, and it comes together again with this refusal to consider himself a victim, or really victimized in the way that that other people in his community have been victimized. And I think, it's not something that I, again, I wanted to dwell on in this book. But I think that is part of the book, and his the silence around that subject, and the silence around ways in which he has been affected, also in a way part of the text.
Yeah. Now, you said he was sort of surrounded by these more kind of interesting characters, or ones that he may at least find more interesting. And one of the, or two of those characters rather, and one of the sort of central relationships of the book, although again it's something which we don't necessarily see play out as readers, is the relationship between Krishan's grandmother and Rani, to whose funeral he is traveling through a great part of the narrative. One thing that struck me in the description, and I was interested to see that it was a word you use in the book, but actually in the publisher's description of the book, they use a slightly different word to refer to Rani. They refer to her as the caregiver, whereas in the book she's referred to as the caretaker. And I'm just curious, first of all, is that a sort of, because obviously the publisher I'm talking about is British based, and you're from Sri Lanka, so I'm wondering, is that a sort of a local difference, or is there
something? What do they say in the UK?
I think caregiver.
Caregiver.
And for us, caretaker would have more the sense of sort of, along the sort of US side of janitor, a sort of a slightly
It's very interesting. And in the text, we have caretaker. Right. Neither of these words, caretaker or caregiver, are words that that we would use in Sri Lanka or in South Asia more generally. We would often say the lady or the woman or the person, or we would refer to have a caretaker or a caregiver, to have somebody working or performing this kind of labor in your house is a middle class thing. It's a middle and upper class thing in South Asia, and among the middle classes you would use the name of the person, or you would say, there's a range of more and less respectful ways of referring to people who do this kind of labor, and there's no easy way to and they're very context dependent, and there's no easy way to put it in English, and I think maybe my ambivalence about which word to use, so the word nurse wouldn't work either, because she's not employed there in a formal capacity, and she doesn't have formal qualifications, and yet she is a kind of this kind of labor, midwiving labor, taking care of the old, cooking, cleaning, all sorts of this kind of nourishing domestic labor is performed, is often paid for by the middle classes. But because it's such a it's a fraught topic, there's no easy way to, I think, to put it.
And so, and it's the kind of profession as well which leads to a certain sort of ambiguity in the relationship, I guess, because obviously the idea of care, of looking after somebody, it's sort of, you would think it comes from a sort of a human affection, a human sort of, it's sort of an emotional act. Whereas when, of course, somebody is being paid to do it, there's this kind of transactional aspect to it. And that's something I found very interesting about the way the relationship between the grandmother and Rani is portrayed in the sort of the light touch way in which you portray it, is this sort of, you seem to sort of embrace that ambiguity, in fact. And it's not sort of like, because something is transactional, therefore it sort of, that undermines the potential for it to be a genuine sort of emotional relationship as well.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of distinction doesn't work in practice between all sorts. Mm. I mean, when it comes to care work or this kind of labor, whether it's cooking, being a cook, being a cleaner, being a sex worker, being a nurse, being a doula, or a midwife, and so, yeah, it doesn't make sense to me, at least, to assume that there is, that these are purely transactional. And they're not, and often they were part of an older pre-transactional life world, which I'm sure was crooked in its structure in many other ways. But to call these relationships transactional when they have older histories doesn't, I mean, I wouldn't assume that.
Yeah. And so Rani comes from the northern province down to Colombo to look after Krishan's grandmother. And one of the things we sort of, which seems to kind of confuse Krishan as well, is sort of why this woman would accept to make this journey, to leave behind her village, to leave behind her family. Could you sort of introduce our listeners who have not yet read the book to the character of Rani and just fill us in a little bit on her backstory and some of the things that might have informed this decision?
Well, Rani is a woman who was born in the northern province, in the northern part of the country, the Tamil-speaking part of the country, in a district called Kilinochi, which was the kind of beating heart of the Tamil Tigers and the separatist movement, especially after the 90s. And so she really grew up, she really spent a lot of her life, got married, had children, ran a house in a separate country, which was then, with the defeat of the Tigers in 2008 and 2009, which kind of crumbled around her. She was subject, like everybody else from this region, to 2 years of non-stop shelling by the Sri Lankan government, a period in which between 40 and 150,000 civilians were killed. And so she's seen great violence, and she has also been affected by this violence. Her youngest son dies in a shell on the penultimate day of the war, May 17, 2009. And her older son joins the Tigers when he's 16 and is killed in fighting. She's been especially affected by the death of her youngest son because he was killed during a shell attack while they're moving between villages. She cannot bury him. And she's traumatized by this, and the memory doesn't leave her. And so even after the end of the war, she's constantly visited by nightmares, by panic attacks, by terrors. She's unable to sleep and is constantly having these visions. And Krishan meets her over the course of his a period of 2 years in which he's doing social work in the north and east, to which he's driven by his guilt, his sense of the comfort of his own life, or the ease of his own life. And so through a series of coincidences, Rani ends up, Krishan's grandmother ends up needing someone to look after her while Krishan and his mother are at work, and by a series of coincidences, Rani enters the picture, and she needs to leave her home in the hopes that she wants to leave her home in the hopes that, or she's advised to leave her home in the hope that she can get away from these sites of trauma. And Colombo's very far; it's the other side of the country, and so she comes to work as the caregiver or caretaker of Krishan's grandmother.
Yeah. And of course, we only really get to meet Rani after we know that she has already died, and has died in a way, I won't go into too much detail, but in a sort of almost sort of accidental way, or at least that's the way it has been understood and the way it's been interpreted. And that seems to trouble Krishan deeply. That seems to sort of to really unsettle something in him, that this woman could have lived through so much violence and lived so close to so much violence and then died in seemingly such an arbitrary way, I guess. What do you think it is about that arbitrariness that really unsettles him so much?
It's this sense, I think, that and this was a real phenomenon of people who had survived, the civilians who had survived all the violence of the last 2 years, who had survived all the bombs and the shells, survived the camps that they were interned in afterwards, and so were seemingly very hardy people, and yet who, in some kind of bizarre, unexpected way, died. There were a lot of accidents that if you read the Tamil news in the years after the war, in the middle pages, you'd see a lot of fires, people falling into wells, a lot of people dying in accidents. Mm-hmm. And Krishan worries that actually there's a seed of some kind has been planted in her, that there's a by the events she's witnessed, there's some kind of trajectory now that has been placed inside her that is now pushing her in various ways towards death. And and there's this this reflection in the early part of the book about this question of whether the death is suicidal or accidental, and what in fact it means to be for death to be accident if one is systematically putting oneself in situations in which something harmful could happen. Like he wonders if there is some urge to eliminate herself or to disappear herself.
Yeah.
That has led to this particular death.
It puts me in mind of an early case of Carl Jung, who he was treating a patient, and the patient told him about a dream where the patient was a keen mountain climber, and he had a dream where he was climbing a mountain, and he got to the top and he continued climbing. And Jung said to him, don't go on your next trip to the mountains. And the guy went on the next trip to the mountains, and he died in an accident during his trip. And I think these are always fascinating sort of situations, because, as you said, sort of like there was this series of things which people could kind of project onto and say, sort of, could this be a sort of an unconscious suicidal urge? But could they also equally be something, for example, in the case of Krishan, because even though the book is not told in the first person, it's told in the kind of close third person. We're always kind of with Krishan's thoughts and his sort of his apprehension of the world. I think sort of equally interesting is this sense of sort of his willingness or perhaps tendency to look for meaning in what other people have described as a sort of a straightforward accident.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Krishan's temperament is such that he's always in some kind of interpretive, undertaking some kind of interpretive project, whether it's the people around him, or whether it's the society of the Northeast, whether it's rituals, rural village rituals that his mother or father might have seen, but that he, having grown up in Colombo, has never seen, and in virtue of being university educated, cannot needs to rationalize in some way, or needs to find an explanation for. So he is in this constant interpretive project, and so perhaps in a way, I mean, yes, he is trying to. I mean, his trip to the north it coincides with this period of not knowing what to do, or not knowing where to go, of having returned to Sri Lanka in the hope of of doing some kind of rehabilitation work in the hope of being part of some kind of reawakening of life and futurity in the Northeast. And he realizes that it's impossible. And with the kind of loss of this life project, he's also at a kind of loss. And the loss has to do very much with the sheer scale of violence, the extent to which society in the Northeast has been destroyed and has become fragmented, and his sense that he cannot orient his life around this project. So
It's that's one thing that really struck me, and I must confess a very cursory knowledge of the situation in Sri Lanka, particularly after the end of the war. But one thing that came across very clearly is this sense of, as you say, like this, the society in the North, it's not like there was a ceasefire and then there was a sort of, as you've seen in some places, a kind of process of reconciliation, of kind of coming together. It really felt like the sort of, as you say, like the approach of the government was then to sort of essentially sort of flatten and sort of to erase traces of the wars. Like, there's moments where you write about graveyards being essentially kind of bulldozed and, you know, and memorials removed and things like that. And that that seems to be a kind of a crucial sort of piece of knowledge for understanding the alienation that Krishan feels, and also perhaps Rani felt in her before she passed away.
Yeah, I think it's certainly connected. I think that's right. It is a very alienating situation. It's a situation in which your greatest devastation, your greatest loss, is not recognized by the institutions of power around you, and therefore in which your history, your biography is not recognized. And there's a, you know, I really don't know. I don't know what it would be like for these deaths or for these acts of genocide to be recognized politically. And I don't know what also reconciliation means. So I wonder what does, it's a nice word, but I don't know what reconciliation for somebody who has lost so much that their life has been crushed, the only life they have, like what would it mean to them to have I don't know, the death of their son or the disappearance of their daughter published somewhere or chiseled into stone somewhere. Will that make the rest of their life worth living? I don't know. I don't know. These are questions I don't have answers for.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, that's the question. Is sort of, could it? What could ever be enough? Like this sort of, this sort of.
Who will be reconciled, and who will be reconciled to what? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. You made me think of a moment where in the book where you're writing about sort of, Krishan has a moment of sort of understanding of the reasons perhaps why Rani acted as she did, and you talk about and I'm afraid it's probably going to be quite a clumsy paraphrase, but this sort of that she sort of created this sort of space or this world kind of in her mind in which she could sort of process isn't quite the right word, because of reconstruct something, a life around her sons, essentially, around the family that she lost. And it struck me that, in fact, a lot of the book is to do with sort of the considering of the interior world as a landscape of some sort of which we navigate. And so with Krishan's journey to the north, and that there was that passage I quoted in the introduction, like it's sort of it's a passage from the southern reaches to the northern reaches of his mind as well. And earlier when you were talking about his father, you said, you know, this was sort of a space that he, you know, had sort of fenced off. And I thought that was really interesting given the general context of the novel. What do you think is the sort of the connection between the sort of the physical space, the sort of exterior landscape, and the sort of the memories and recollections and sort of perhaps processing things like grief and trauma? Do you think the sort of it is possible to separate the two, like you talked about the Tamil diaspora earlier? Do you think these are being sort of separated from the context of the trauma and of the violence makes it harder in some way to accept?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think so. Incidentally, there is a big Tamil diasporic population in La Chapelle here in Paris, they've been the businesses still remain, but over the last 10 years or so, they've been the prices have been increasing, and they've been pushed out into various suburbs. One of which is Sevron. I don't know if you've been there, but they have they have a little memorial stone to that they've planted in a public garden, actually, with the municipality of Sevron, memorializes although they've also inscribed a number of dead. I can't remember what it was, maybe 15,000 or 40,000, and my friend who was showing it to me told me that was before we knew the real death count, and so, but we can't afford a new stone. We can't get it rechiseled, but I do think in various spaces that are safe, people try to find ways to memorialize in concrete and in physical ways. There's this question, I mean, in the book, there's this discussion about memory and how memory needs objects to function, that it is tied to objects, and when you remove the objects or the physical, the concrete existences that are tied to specific times or phases, you also remove our anchor to those times and phases. And there is also this thing about this is long description of mourning, of the mourning rituals, the Saivite mourning rituals of the people of the of a number of Tamils in the north and east, and it talks about the significance of an object in those rituals, the way in which those rituals are organized around the object of grief becoming increasingly insubstantial, the movement from the corpse to the ash to the photograph, increasingly virtual and increasingly more abstract, but how an object is needed, the corpse is needed. And 2008 and 2009, most people who lost relatives, everybody lost somebody, had to leave the body behind, or were in a context in a camp in which they could not take the body through the stages that are part of the funeral ritual. So objects are required for mourning too, and most of these people even lacked objects. The people who survived had to cross a lagoon. They'd been traveling across the northeast for 2 years, and then finally they're progressively leaving more and more of their things behind, and the final stage they had to cross a large lagoon. And at this stage, most of them were only able to hold on to identity cards, not photographs. They had to give up even photographs, which were before the ID cards, which were needed, they knew, to be processed by the Sri Lankan army. They gave away, left behind, a lot of them had to leave behind photos. So even this final stage of grief, they were no longer able to pass through. And so there's this question of, yes, what happens when you're not able to physically, for whatever reason, political or catastrophic. You are not able to, you don't have the physical tokens or the physical objects by which memory, imagination, mourning, commemoration, and collective gathering are possible. One needs to find a virtual space,
mm-hmm.
in which this is possible. And so the novel is thinking through that a lot, and what those virtual spaces might be, the degree to which they exist in the mind, the degree to which they exist on the internet,
mm-hmm.
In which they're archived in various difficult to find, inaccessible or invisible spaces.
Mm-hmm. And potentially the degree to which they can then maybe be kind of remapped onto the territory. I mean, I asked that just with the with Krishan's kind of physical journey through space, like the train journey he takes to the north. We get the sense as readers that there's something about the sort of the act of passing across the landscape that he's able to, so it sort of it stirs his memories, it sort of provokes something in him, and it, that allows him to perhaps piece together certain memories and certain feelings in a way that he hadn't been able to before.
Yeah, there's this passage where he that describes his first entry into the Northeast after the war, a place that he'd imagined so much and that he'd seen so many images of and so many documentaries of and heard so much about, and how he feels like he's walking across some distant region in the outskirts of his mind, and there's this sense that two visions have been superimposed on one another, or that there's some kind of stereoscopic, I believe you call it, when the real and the virtual are suddenly in alignment in some kind of way, and it's a very strange feeling. For example, he describes, there's a section in the book that describes him walking very lightly across certain pieces of certain stretches of land, even though, you know, people are like digging the land, people are walking, they're like like throwing trash or whatever. He, being an outsider who has only imagined this space, treads very lightly because he knows people have died here, or because he feels that or senses that people have died here. And so the book is also a lot about the contradictions or the misalignments that happens from that the process of stereoscoping.
And it strikes me as well that there's this sort of there's something about having a trajectory at all seems to be something which he which Krishan sort of feels a need of, or something which he felt a lack of at the beginning. Like, there's quite a few references to the horizon, and there's something, it's funny, sort of having grown up by the sea and having lived in kind of a landlocked city for particularly over the last few years, hardly leaving it at all, I've really come to realize how important the horizon is to me, but as a kind of almost a sort of a soothing, a sort of reassuring presence. And one thing that was interesting reading this book is that sort of that's not quite the feeling we have of the horizon as kind of Krishan reflects upon it. It's almost like there's something, I guess something sort of looming on the horizons. And so something could kind of, it could be good, it could be bad, but there's this sort of unknown presence just beyond where he can see, and it's something which also completely surrounds him. And so, you know, the horizon could be heading off to his left, to his right, or whatever. And the comparison with another character who we haven't talked about yet, but who's crucial to this book, Andrum, his ex-girlfriend, who I think there's one moment where, you know, she says to him, you know, basically, my life is going in this direction and your life doesn't seem to be going in any direction at all. And it seems to be that part of his, I don't like this word, but kind of his journey, so to speak, in A Passage North is having a direction.
Right. You
know, not necessarily the right direction, the good one, but just being right. able to move in one sense seems right. In some way important to him.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think in that the importance of trajectory or direction to Krishan, or the sense that it's been lost, or that there was something that maybe around which he could organize his life, mm-hmm. But that it's now lost. I mean, that I think it mimics a kind of loss of trajectory in the Tamil community, because I think so long as the tigers existed, the Tamil tigers, it seemed that a future state in the Northeast, for better or worse, whatever kind of state it turned out to be, and whatever rulers the Tamil tigers turned out to be, that there was something in the future,
mm-hmm.
Something that could be good,
mm-hmm.
or could be bad, but something in the future on which we can stake ourselves, mm-hmm. and on which and whose nature will depend on us, mm-hmm. and on what we contribute to it, whether people were whether one was happy for this, mm-hmm. possibility or this sense of the future, or whether one was not, it existed.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that that there is some future that possibly one will have a hand in,
mm-hmm.
And so with the end of the war and with the total devastation of society in the Northeast, that loss of direction or loss, mm-hmm. of trajectory has been very palpable. That loss of direction and loss of that direction and the trajectory helps, or can, that kind of direction can help a lot of people deal with a lot of difficult situations, mm-hmm. can with otherwise very painful and very very difficult lives.
Yeah.
And that pain and the difficulty has increased, but now the direction has disappeared.
Mm. And I guess one of those people who has that sort of has found as a direction is Anjum, and like she's got her sort of political activism. And one thing that's very striking is that sort of, you know, they have this relationship, but there's never a sense really that Krishan is going to follow her down that path. Like there doesn't seem to be a sort of tendency to ideology in him, or to sort of activism in a way, and it doesn't seem to be like it's something that is particularly, you know, philosophical. It just seems almost, mm-hmm. essential to his being, mm-hmm. that he's not a kind of an ideological person.
Right. Yeah. I think. Yeah, he's very introspective. He reflects a lot. He's often uncertain about his reflections. Mm-hmm. So. Questions his knowledge of subjects. He seems more interested in dwelling on these things, mm-hmm. than he does on capable of dwelling than he does of acting, mm-hmm. upon these situations. I think that is right. I think that is his temperament.
And he seems drawn as well towards Buddhism, or at least to certain of the, I don't know if it's the kind of the potential for sort of transcending certain things like desire or something like that.
It does exist in a lot of strands of Hinduism too.
True. And in other religions as well. Like I know there's a moment where he talks about sort of giving himself over to a higher power, or the capacity, yeah. to do that, which of course is sort of like fundamental to sort of things like Alcoholics Anonymous, which are founded, yes, in sort of, yes. like Christian sort of ideology.
But. This book is also about the idea of devotion,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's Anjum's devotion to a cause or the devotion of early Tamil separatists or, mm-hmm. tiger cadres to their cause, One of the subjects of this book is also conviction,
mm-hmm.
and devotion, and that, and specifically the religious devotion that involves belief in another world. Mm-hmm. This is how I mm-hmm. distinguish. I mean, for me, a belief is religious, or an ideology is religious, if it involves belief in a world that is in some significant way cut off from mm-hmm. our own.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, in this sense, Rani
mm-hmm.
is a devotee of the world that contains her sons,
mm-hmm.
which she is cut off from now, and Anjum is a devotee of a world that she wants to bring about, but is cynical.
Mm-hmm.
It will ever happen, and the separatists
mm-hmm.
were all devotees
mm-hmm.
of another world, a world that they're willing to die for. I mean, it's this kind of belief in another world that
mm-hmm.
really, I mean, it's a kind of the force that has been harnessed by a lot of people and a lot of movements.
Mm-hmm.
And Krishan himself is drawn to this kind of mm-hmm. like to religious thought or religious literature.
Mm. Although it strikes me drawn to it, but perhaps not. I don't know. Not that he there seems to be almost a sort of a fundamental sort of incapacity to necessarily kind of take the step of giving himself over to it in a way. Maybe it's his sort of, you talked about his kind of reflective sort of temperament, sort of analytical temperament, and then perhaps is, I don't know, like, again, it's sort of it's something that I say this because it's something I feel I recognize in myself as well.
Yeah.
This sort of like this being attracted to certain philosophies and certain religions, but sort of being in some way sort of fundamentally unsuited to taking that final sort of devotional step, the leap of faith, I guess.
Right. Well, you know, I wrote my dissertation on William James,
huh.
on the varieties of religious experience.
Right, okay.
Yeah. I don't know if you've read that book.
Yeah.
It's really one
yeah.
of my favorite philosophical texts. I don't know. I mean, it really depends on how you understand
mm-hmm.
The notion of another world, right?
Yeah,
in a sense, Krishan's commitment before he returns to the Northeast of building in his mind, of reconstructing
mm-hmm.
in his mind the events of the war, reconstructing in his mind the world that has been destroyed,
mm-hmm.
is also a kind of devotional act or religious
sure.
act.
I'd like to, we're running out of time, but one thing I'd like to finish on is just a sort of, I guess it's a more sort of writerly question in a way. The one thing that really struck me about A Passage North is that at certain moments the book wears its kind of literary devices on its sleeve in a way, and I think that's partly due to the kind of the temperament of Krishan, and we spend so much time with him. So again, like that that idea that I quoted in the introduction of sort of I suppose what I'm saying is perhaps less kind of assured writers might sort of take that idea of, okay, it's not just a passage, you know, a physical passage north, but also a sort of a psychological mental passage north. But they would never perhaps state it outright for fear that they sort of, you know, the reader may, you know, they would let the reader discover it for themselves, let's say. And there's something I found incredibly refreshing and incredibly sort of, I suppose the word I have came to mind, it kind of like roots me as a reader, was kind of feeling that you were sort of able to kind of to assert these things,
mm-hmm.
sort of what the book was doing, what Krishan was doing,
mm-hmm.
in the way his thought process was working, without feeling that it was sort of in any way sort of being too sort of exposing too much the sort of the workings of the text. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, you should have seen the early drafts. Well, you know, I think, I don't know what that has to do with. I would say it probably has to do with, I'm not a very, I don't tend towards subtlety in my writing, I think. There may be more subtle moments from time to time, but I do tend towards explicitness. Mm-hmm. I do tend towards statement. Mm-hmm. It comes from a certain kind of impatience, mm-hmm. I think. And I can think of a few reasons. I didn't actually have any formal education in English literature or in any kind of literature, actually. And my entry into reading really happened through philosophy,
mm-hmm.
where, as you know, one doesn't show at all, one only tells.
Right. Yeah.
And I was drawn to philosophy for this reason. I've always been also drawn to self-help. The only books that I had that we had in our house growing up were maybe a few self-help books, mm-hmm. in English that my father did when he was young. And these books, they're explicit. They have the virtue that where they go wrong, it's obvious that they've gone wrong because they've shown their cards. And so I guess because of this early exposure to self-help, maybe, and also because I entered literature through philosophy, which is all about making things explicit, I sometimes grow impatient. This is just a personal thing, but I grow impatient with writers who tend to work through allusion,
mm-hmm.
who tend to work by circling. I mean, I've tried to become more patient. I think I have with this book. Learned how to use strategies that are a little less looking straightforward,
mm-hmm.
To be able to approach things obliquely. But for whatever reason, I also don't understand, in a time when the novel is constantly incorporating new different kinds of discourse, whether that's poetic discourse, whether that's memoir, or whether that's art criticism, why should it also not be literary criticism? And why should that literary criticism also not be directed to the text,
mm-hmm.
Itself? Why should the text try to hide what it's doing, in some sense? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think for me, that the sort of the effect that has is in sort of avoiding that kind of elusive approach. It allows for a kind of a subtlety and complexity to sort of to blossom within the text in a sort of a more sort of organic way, I suppose.
I'm glad you felt that way.
And Nick, that's all we've got time for. Thank you so much for joining us today. Of course, A Passage North is available in store at Shakespeare and Company, on the Shakespeare and Company website, or from your local neighborhood independent bookstore, wherever you're listening from. All that remains for me to say is, yeah, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for reading the book.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast with me, Adam Biles. Since you've made it this far, I hope that means you've enjoyed what you've heard and will consider rating us in whatever app you're using. The theme music is Mr. Ginger by the incredible jazz musician Alex Fryman, taken from his album Play It Gentle. I'll be back next week. Until then, take care, happy reading, and thanks again for listening.